Welcome to the Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy podcast. I'm Declan, the son.
And I'm Jane, the mom. This is the podcast where we talk about brutal crimes, bizarre occurrences, and get you drunk with cocktails themed around one of our stories. To lighten things up, we'd like to end our time with a chaser. Please keep in mind some of our stories might be upsetting to young or sensitive ears.
We love hearing from our listeners, so feel free to contact us by email or social media. You can find our contact info in the show notes for this episode. If you'd like to support us through Patreon, you can find us there at Brutal, Bizarre, and Boozy Podcast, or use the link in our show notes.
Yeah, hi, everyone. Welcome back. We have a really fun and different episode for you guys today. We don't have our usual drink and brutal and bizarre stories. We have some authors who are here to tell us about their really cool book about UFOs and aliens and the fun stuff that we like to talk about on our regular episode. They're going to tell us about more in depth because they've done the research. So we have Leslie and Stephen Shaw with us today.
Hi, everybody.
Hello.
And before we get to your book, you, because of who we are, and we had to bring in the boozy part, you brought a drink for us to try today.
Yeah.
Well, we don't have it with us, but we have the...
Yeah, I gave him the recipe, yeah. Though.
Well,
it's
we made the drink.
Here on the West Coast, so a little early for day drinking for me.
Oh, well, you know, we record at all times of the day or night, yeah. So we drink whenever.
Yeah. I would, but I fall asleep if I...
Well, there's if that. We don't want to fall asleep. So the drink. Right. What was the name of the drink that you brought?
I call
us?
It a Russian float.
Russian float. And what is the recipe for the Russian float?
You pack a glass with ice, and any size, it doesn't matter. But then you'll you pour 1/3 high of vodka to start. Then 1/3 of some cream liqueur like Bailey's or Caroline's or McCormick's, something like that. And then top it off with root beer. And the root beer mixes with the cream stuff and creates a little bit of foam at the top, like a root beer float does, right. A little bit. So it's actually really fun and tastes really good.
Looks pretty good. Yeah, I'm excited for this.
Okay, I'm going to give mine a try.
Oh, so they did get the recipe already.
That's actually really
tasty. That's pretty
tasty.
Isn't
that
good? Yeah.
Yeah, I like that.
And I guess you know, how it, like the root beer float reacts in that, it tends to almost stir it too. So you don't have to like take a spoon to it and stir it. It stirs itself sort of.
Yeah. Like ramps up the bubbles somehow. It's super good.
Awesome. Well, thank you for bringing that. It's really tasty. I'm going to enjoy this drink for sure.
Thank you.
So what is the name of your book?
The title is Who They Are and What They're Up To by Leslie and Stephen Shaw. It's available on Amazon and Ingram Books. And we also have an Instagram page that where we're doing Stephen's family's stories, their bizarre experiences. We put them in little series. Sorry about that. Turn off the phone. And where was I?
Oh, the vignettes.
Oh, yes, the Instagram. It's at leslie.shaw.author.
That's the Instagram handle. And the same as the Facebook handle, too, is the same.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. We will link...
leslie.shaw.author.
Right. We will link that page in our show notes. And then also we'll tag you in an Instagram post for this so that people can find it really easy if they don't want to type in all the letters, because... some people might be lazy like me and rather click a link than type in the letters.
Yeah, and our website is whotheyarebook.com.
That's right. There's a few blogs and excerpts and links to any podcasts we do. So
awesome. So how did you guys get interested in this topic and decide to write a book?
Well, yeah, I've quite frankly, I really started doing my first serious research back in about 1991. I decided I wanted to start getting to the bottom of what had been happening in my family for three generations that just wasn't making sense. I was an acupuncturist, practicing acupuncturist here in California for 20 years and a Tai Chi teacher for 23. And things just weren't adding up, especially when I started to think back when I was 3 years of age, where I'd be visited by this invisible being that was about like the size of like a cat that would jump on my stomach and my chest in the middle of the night in a playful type manner. Now, I grew up in a family that was post wartime England, grew up in wartime England in Manchester, and, you know, very no-nonsense people. And I was told from being a very young child that we had this family spirit guide named O'Glegley that was a protector of the family and that would show up from time to time for different people for different reasons. And, you know, even people that were outside of the family. And so I just kind of grew up with this kind of like, you know, okay, this paranormal type of thing. Okay. All right. So, I just accepted it. Didn't tell my friends about it, but I just accepted it.
And when I married Stephen, I started hearing about all his crazy family experiences, and they were just bizarre.
Not crazy. Don't use the word crazy.
Sorry. Well, it sounded like that to me at the time. And I had never seen anything. I'd never experienced anything unusual like that. And but I believed him. It's just that, you know, when you don't see it yourself, you can only believe maybe 95% or so. And then I finally saw my first UFO in 2005. And then I became 100% believer after that. We were driving home late one night, and up in the sky ahead of us was a white light. And I thought maybe it's a plane flying into Palm Springs Airport, but then it didn't behave like a plane. It just hovered there in the sky, and there were no extra flashing lights, like
no running lights. No running lights, right.
And then the thing took off at what had to be 20,000 miles an hour, and it took off so fast that visually it streaked into a line that collapsed behind it, and it was gone over the northern horizon in about a quarter of a second. It was so fast, and it went at full speed instantly too. Not, it didn't ramp up to 20,000 miles an hour, just instantly whoosh, gone. And you know, a white light in the sky can be any number of things, but when it rockets away at 20,000 miles an hour, and then no, it can't be anything else.
It wasn't a meteorite or a star or anything like that.
Right.
It's a lot harder to explain that.
Yeah. They hover for, they don't hover, you know, meteors and stuff.
No.
No.
They don't do that. Yeah. They don't do the right turn to Albuquerque thing, you know?
Yeah.
Right.
And so it was about then that I'm the writer in the family. I'm a journalist by trade. And Stephen wrote his family's history into the book himself, and we also are each other's researchers. We both do our research together, but you know, I had to do the lion's share of the typing part for sure. And we started, you know, with our research. We first looked into the idea that these beings are coming here from distant star systems. But that quickly started to not make sense. And when we changed our theories to be more localized, and that these beings are closer cousins to humanity, that's when everything started going snick, snick, snick. It started fitting into place. And like I say, in the beginning, our research, it was stretching credulity that these things were coming from distant star systems. For one thing, they're seen so often. There's 10,000 reportings worldwide per year, year.
Yeah, the factual data was not the linking up with what, you know. In fact, about 10% of the cases that are seen or get reported, so it's really closer to about 100,000, according to the U.S. Military.
Sightings per year.
That they're sighted all the time. Whenever we go out in military operations, it's every single time.
So
is
that
the Ryan Graves? Is that
Yes. Yeah, partly.
That's yeah.
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 Is that 10?
That was one of the questions I had for you, is what you thought about that. And you just answered it for me. So yeah. Perfect.
Those hearings were just wonderful for us.
She had a question for us.
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry.
I just had a question. The number of sightings, is that 10,000 different accounts, or like if there's, or is that 10,000?
Yeah, it's reports. So yes, it could be more than one person seeing the same thing.
Okay.
But, okay.
So yeah. If it's reports, one,
not people. Yeah.
Reports. One event that could be, so the 10,000, is that 10,000 individual events or reports?
Reports.
Individual okay. events.
No, reports.
Reports. Yeah. Well, you know, each yeah. report is an event. But it can be you can witness by 1,000 people.
Yeah, like for instance, yeah. one sighting that I found after I wrote the book. We wrote the book, so I didn't include it. It'll be in the next book though, for sure.
The Michigan, right?
The Michigan Lake sighting, where 300 people called in to the cops saying there's a UFO in my backyard. You know.
Yeah.
So that's one incident, but 300 reports of
gotcha.
About okay. 20 UFOs were spotted. So
yeah, we're wow. talking about 10,000 incidents per year.
Okay.
Which equals like, you know,
no reports.
Well, the reports, but reports can, reports can be 300, report can be 300 people at one report, right?
No, these are individual people calling in.
Oh, okay. I see how you're looking at it. Okay. All right.
Yes, that's sorry.
So to go back to your sighting, Leslie, you mentioned Palm Springs, and I was curious where you had your sightings, because I just got back from Palm Springs, actually.
Oh,
so.
Okay. Yeah, our meeting was in Joshua Tree, and okay. we were coming home to Yucca Valley on the Highway 62. Okay. And 62 dumps into Palm Springs, and then you have to go up over a pass, a couple of passes to get to Yucca Valley.
Okay.
So it's called the Morongo Basin. It's a valley up above Palm Springs, about 3,000 feet higher elevation.
Okay.
Yeah. Joshua Tree is famous for UFO sightings. It seems to be kind
Yucca
of a
Valley's
hotbed.
Yucca Valley is about 30-minute drive from Palm Springs, mm-hmm. roughly.
I definitely wonder if Joshua Tree is because, if there's a lot of sightings because it's so open. I mean, it's flat. You know, we're not going to get a lot of sightings in our town from one side to the other because of the mountains. But
there's a possible reason for that, too. That's also military, because the 29 Palms Naval Marine Base, which I've worked on, especially when I was in the Navy, it's only just it's next door to Joshua Tree, and it's almost 1,000 square miles.
Yeah, it's an enormous Marine Corps base out there. And you're right, Naval Station as well. And also, Joshua Tree is on a ley line, and I have ideas that possibly the UFOs, when they take off at these hypersonic speeds, I wonder if they're not following ley lines on the planet. That was a theory I tossed around, but I haven't confirmed it yet. So
well, in that area, right next door is Landers, and that's where the Integratron is, and also the giant rock. They're like almost like within 5 miles of each other. So yes, it is an area like when we used to live on the Upper Mesa, we would see electrical storms like you would not believe out towards 29 Palms. Literally, you'd be like seeing 100 strikes, you know, in 2 minutes. You know, it would be like just the whole sky would be lit up. So like no other place I've seen. Maybe Lake Maracaibo in Ecuador might have the same type of
Venezuela
is it? Yeah. But anyways, it's a very active area for sure because of the military. And by the way, the black helicopters, the silent black helicopters, they do exist. I saw them with six other people at Giant Rock. And the only reason that we knew that they were there is because they were being backlit by a full moon. And they were literally only like 200 feet over our head. They did this pathway. Two of them went right over our heads and right over Giant Rock that went back to the military base. This was about 2005.
And they were silent.
And they were silent. You wouldn't know they were there. And if it were a dark night, you would have no clue they were there. You couldn't hear a thing. So, yeah, we do know they have that technology, at least that technology. I can tell you for a fact.
It's under
and,
my
when
impression
I was in college,
that
I studied ancient art history too, and that came in very handy for writing the book as well.
Declan, you got a question?
It's under my impression that a lot of the more recent UFO sightings, I believe, are made by the military. It's that I do believe that there are aliens visiting from other places, but I think the military has something similar, and a lot of these sightings are them testing it out or running on little missions or whatever.
Yeah, they've been trying to reverse engineer the technology for since the 40s, so they're having
Roswell.
A certain amount of success, certainly with the silent black helicopters. They've managed to make the most UFOs are silent. That's one key aspect to them, and the exception is sometimes people hear a humming sound that they is more felt than heard. They feel it on a like a vibrational level.
If they get too close. Yes.
Yeah, and if you're that close, if you're feeling that, you're too close.
I don't
want to
back
away.
No, thank you.
Yeah, the radiation burns. It's you know, at least from the 60s and 70s, people were still getting radiation burns for sure. Even like the 1980s with Rendlesham in Great Britain, there was still, you know, whether technology is improved or whatnot, we don't know 100%, but we do know that they have a lot of skin in the game. That's why they're so concerned about our nukes. They absolutely show, watch what they do, not what they say. And what our cousins, what we call cousins, are doing is that they're very concerned about what we are currently been doing for the past 60, 70, 80 years, actually.
Yes. They're very concerned about our nuclear weapons. They're following our military every time we go out on maneuvers. And they're not just our military, but China and Russia. Anyone with nukes, they're dogging their steps everywhere mm-hmm. they go. I think they're just making sure that we don't blow the planet up. And we think that because a lot of them are here, stationed here, that they have skin in the game as well, as Steve says. And if we blow up the planet, we're be killing them too. That's why they're showing such concern for it. And that was something we learned from the hearings last summer. The pilots, Graves and Fravor and Grush, the whistleblower from the intelligence department, David Grush was there, and they, you know, it was for ufology community. It was not news to us that we have crashed ships and dead alien bodies and possibly some live ones too. That didn't strike us as news, except that it was wonderful to hear it read on the floor of the congression, the House of Representatives, and read into the congressional record for once. But the thing when Graves was talking about how often they're seen, I didn't realize that they were seen every single time that we go out. That was news to me. And I knew they were very interested in our nukes, and frequently the UFOs are seen around military bases, and especially bases that have anything to do with nuclear weapons or nuclear power or nuclear research.
And some of the, and so, a lot of them look like they're kind of like very, very advanced drones. Especially the ones that are spheres that have a like a black cube that are inside them. They're about 15 feet across.
Right.
Of course, you know, hypersonic speeds and soundless and that kind of stuff. And, you know, so
we think they use those as like spy drones.
Yeah.
It was Graves rather. Graves, he was with the Red Ripper Squadron out of Oceana on the East Coast.
Virginia.
And he says that it looks like it's about a 15-foot clear glass sphere, and inside of it is this gray or black cube.
Spinning cube.
And they spin. I've noticed that a lot of these orbs, I call them, for lack of a better word, they when they're hovering, this black cube tends to spin inside, and it causes this kind of flickering as you look at them. And we think that they use these as spy drones. Obviously, we don't think they're manned craft because they're only 15 feet in diameter. So unless the aliens are really tiny, and we don't think mm-hmm. so, we think they're using them as just monitoring equipment.
So another story I heard from that congressional hearing was Robert Salis. He was in charge of I believe it was 10 nuclear warheads.
Yes, that's the Malmstrom incident in Montana.
Yes, the Malmstrom Bay. Yeah, mm-hmm. that one's extremely worrying. Yeah, and it fits along with the... Yes, yes, and it fits right along with that. They're concerned with our nuclear weapons. So.
Yep.
Yeah, they've been showing their their actions have been bespeaking what they actually really want to let us know that they can do it. They've done this in England. They've done it in Russia, in China. They definitely done it here.
And more than once here too. The Minot incident is another nuclear silo incident involving a UFO. They're definitely, it was a message to us, I believe, just we can turn off your weapons anytime we want to.
Yeah.
But you know, we have like so many tens of thousands of them right now, and how many of them are still active, we really don't know. It's just there is an agreement that we found too. That's it seems to be pretty obvious. The agreement is that okay, we'll share some of our technology as long as you can continue to let us to harvest some of your DNA.
Right.
Not just human, but, domesticated animals. And again, it's because they live here. They've been living here for a long time.
Thousands of years, we believe. Yes.
They breed with us because it's easy for them. They communicate with us because they use telepathy. If you use telepathy, a lot of people don't realize, because I was a doctor for 20 years, and telepathy is nothing more than using symbolic pictographic language, but used on a mental base. When you think of a tree, you don't think of first. The first thing you think of is T-R-E-E. You see a tree in your head. Okay. So the first symbolic languages, that's why you see the pictographs from the American Indians and all around the world, symbolic language, ideographs, pictograms, things as that. Because that, otherwise these aliens, which we call our cousins, would have to know literally over 4,000 different languages.
Right.
Okay, but no, it's a more and more basic thing. How the human brain is wired to think in concepts. That's how they get around it.
And that's why we think how telepathy works in their case, that they can communicate with anyone, no matter what their language, because they're communicating on a mental concept.
A much more primal of communication.
And we think that's further proof that they're closely related to us, in that if you can have a telepathic communication between two minds, in my opinion, it means that those minds are probably fairly similar to one another.
Mm-hmm. Wired very similar.
And then we started looking into the abduction phenomenon because we believe that's what's been happening to Stephen's family. Frequently in Stephen's family, the family member would see something strange and then maybe even be frightened to the point of terror where their heart is pounding. Mm-hmm. And then the next thing they know, they black out, like as if they just fell asleep. And nobody falls asleep when their heart is pounding and they're terrified, right? Nope. But somehow they have the ability to dampen the consciousness of a person and knock them out and then abduct them. And the closer we looked at the abduction phenomenon, the more it just wasn't fitting with current theories. The theories at the time we began doing our research was that the aliens are just curious about humans. They just want to take a few samples. No big deal. I'm going to take a sample, put you back, no problem. But that really wasn't what was happening. What we discovered was that it tends to run in families. And once they find a particular DNA strand that they like, a genetic strand that they like, they will take that person again and again and again and again through their lives. And then they'll start taking their children, and then they'll start taking their grandchildren. And that's why it's a multi-generational phenomenon. In Stephen's family's history, we think it started about three generations ago, where they were experiencing visitations by this entity called O'Glegley. It's called the Family Spirit Guide. And the Family Spirit Guide was also protecting the family. And the way I make the analogy in the book is that it's like a cow. A farmer has a cow, right? And he needs the milk out of the cow. So he puts the cow out into the field and it eats grass and makes milk. Then he abducts the cow every morning into the barn, removes the milk, and then puts the cow out in the field to make more. That's what I think is going on with us, except for it's for genetic material that they're after, eggs, sperm, and the like. And so they put us back and let us regenerate more of that what they need, and then take us again and take it again and take it again. And protect, a farmer protects his prize cow from predators. And so the family
prize
spirit
horse,
guide.
Prize cow, yeah.
Yeah, in Stephen's case, the family spirit guide, which we believe are the tall gray aliens, because
my brother saw them.
His brother actually saw them. In Steve's case, we've tried to regress him into being able to remember those big blackout areas whenever he'd see something strange and blackout afterwards. We've been trying through hypnosis to break through that barrier. But in Steven's case, the block is just too hard to break through.
But there is a lot of stuff in the book there, though, too. I saw a tall blue-white entity that was 6 to 7 feet tall. It's in the beginning of the book as far as, like, your personal experiences that were experienced by my father and my sister and my mother and my younger brother, Philip. But in two different homes that were 350 miles apart. So this all happened in 1979 in January, and it culminated where I was paralyzed on the right side of my body at about 5:30 in the morning, and by this blue-white entity that whispered, "Hi, Steve," into my ear, and I just assumed I was going to see the family spirit guide. I was 18 years of age, and I just assumed I'm going to meet Old Glegley, you know, that I'd heard about. So, you know, half of me is like excited to meet this entity, this being that I thought was a spirit guide. But the other half of me was terrified because I could not move. So, and you know, I was always taught from a kid that Old Glegley was this tall black man that wore a red fez that had manifested to many different people in the family. But this was an intense blue-white entity that brought this blue-white energy all into the house with it. The whole house, the living room, was filled with this intense blue-white light. And so I couldn't look at it. But I couldn't even close my eyes. And it just, I guess, a sense that I was like a little terrified. And then it left. And then I black out. I can't remember what happened after that. I don't remember if I got up and told my dad whatever. But I do know what did happen. 6 hours later, 11:30 in the morning, I was going to get some lunch for my dad and I, and I reached in my right-hand side pocket of the clothes I had been wearing that night, for other reasons. I was just terrified to sleep in my room because of what happened the night before. So I reached into my pocket to get the coins out, and they were all magnetic. All these coins, just the standard American coins. My dad could pick them up. I could pick them up. Didn't matter by the edge, by the side, whatever. We picked them up, and we just looked. Go ahead. All right. Okay. So it was just one of these things that, you know, it was. Things happened during that week that my mom, everybody in the family experienced either together or a little bit separately, you know, including things such as hearing a silver bell on the wall that my dad, my sister, and I all heard two nights before that. That went on for about 15 minutes. And then I had my shoulder tapped on three times in my room the night after that. My bed was pushed three times, two times at a time, from the base of the bed was pushed, just like somebody was like pushing the base of the bed to wake you up. And then I was tapped on my right shoulder, and I whizzed around, just getting really, I was very scared and but very annoyed too. And I said, "What?" And I knew there was something there, but I couldn't see it. And then I just blacked out.
Again, when his heart is pounding and he's frightened.
And my brother saw, when he was 16, he saw at the other house that we were building, because I was a cabinet making a carpenter with my dad. He was awakened on three nights in a row. First night by these two intense white lights outside of his window, and his window faced a creek that was on our property and woods. There was no driveway
roads or anything
there. Okay. It was a drop off. So then he blacked out. The next night he was awakened by this scrabbling sound under his bed, and he just thought it was one of the cats. So he reached down to pet the cat, and this hand grabbed him by the wrist.
Blacked out. After his blood pressure and adrenaline pinned to the ceiling,
and then blacks out.
And then the next night,
he was awakened by this tall, about 6 to 6.5 foot tall, skinny gray that was standing in his doorway. He looked at it again, and then just blacked out.
Again.
That's how we kind of know that this Old Glegley character is really a tall gray that will manifest, or has been manifesting in our opinion, has been manifesting to the family in slightly different forms, but the form is about the same. It's about 6 to 7 feet tall and skinny, okay? And it has been protecting us. It saved my uncle's life in Sri Lanka, which was Ceylon at the time. He was in the
protecting that cow.
Yeah. He married my mother's older sister, and he was in the Royal Air Force, and he was awakened in the middle of the night by this tall black man wearing a fez that said, "Douglas," just happened to know his name, said, "Douglas, you need to get up right now and get out because you're going to be killed." And then he just disappeared
right in front
and
of them.
Doug got up. He knew intuitively that it was Oglegly because he'd heard about Oglegly. And he got out, and about a minute or two later, a rebel party came through with machetes and with guns and killed several of his fellow pilots. And he told me this story a couple times when I was a young man. And again, he grew up in wartime England. He was not for fits of fancy. He was a very, you know, British.
Yeah, they're normally very stodgy.
Yeah, so it's like British, you know. I just accepted this stuff. And again, this is not stuff that we talked about with our friends at school, because they think either that you're lying or that you're crazy or you're growing up in a haunted house. So I didn't talk about these strange things that happened all through my childhood.
Right.
You know?
And so one of the things that never made
sense.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Do you and your family still experience Oglegly today?
You do.
I had a visitation about 2.5 months ago by this very large being that was in our bedroom, and I was about ready to get up to, you know, go to the bathroom, and there was this, and I've seen this entity a few times in the past few years, and he's taller and wider now, and he has golden eyes, the way he's appeared to me the last few times. And I asked him this last time, I said, "What do you want of me? What do you want from me?"
And we never get the answer.
And I did not get the answer. But I've had another time where he held my hand. It was very, very comforting. That was about 10 years ago. My sister, she does the psychic stuff, the ghost hunting, ghostly locations.
Yeah, they're ghost hunters in Northern England.
And she uses what she calls a crystal, and then uses different devices. She's got like FLIR cameras and all that, but she uses devices, and she's in contact with my dead father and dead mother and my dead brother and a couple other beings. She's kind of been keeping in practice with that kind of stuff. I kind of gave up on a lot of that stuff. I used to use it in my acupuncture practice all the time.
But we think the family's experiences are not hauntings, because hauntings tend to be fused to a location. Whereas in the family's case, this phenomenon follows them all over the place. It followed them from Germany to England, and then from England to California, then Southern California, then to mid California where they built their house.
It's followed me to 6 different locations so far, myself, that I know of.
It's definitely more attached to the family, as far as we can tell.
Can you see it too, Leslie?
No, I don't. Okay. I've seen 2 UFOs, and that's the sum total of my paranormal witnessing. I don't know, though. I could have been taken and not remembered. When I was reading Whitley Strieber's book, he talks about being taken right next to his sleeping wife with his daughter right over sleeping over there, and this taking him right out the front door without anybody waking up. So it's certainly possible.
I had that weekend. 1979, the last thing that happened, my dad was, this was the night after that the coins were magnetized. I went back to sleep in my bedroom, and my dad was awakened to see this blue-white wall of light coming out of my bedroom, okay, encompassing the whole doorway. And he just was of the thing, I'm going to get up and see what's going on. He was just getting kind of like, you know, ticked off and scared, you know, so he's getting out of bed. And then a voice inside his head said, "Go back to sleep, Jeffrey. Nothing to see here.
Everything's fine.
It was a voice that was right inside his head, just making these pictures. Go back to sleep. And he went back to sleep. And I have no recollection of that blue-white light at all. They could have taken semen samples. They could have abducted me.
He could have 27 hybrid children that we
I really have no clue. But, you know, I have missing time. I had missing time. The first missing time I can remember when I was 9 years old, where I was awakened by a strange sound. And I knew it wasn't the family dog. So I got out of my bunk bed, out of the top, and I was walking down the hall when I knew something was wrong. I didn't know what was wrong, but my heart was pounding. I was breathing heavy, and I was like really scared about what I was going to see when I went to the living room. And next thing I know, I'm back in my bed 2 or 3 hours later, all nicely tucked back in, and with no clue of what happened during that time of going down the hallway and somehow getting back and climbing back into my bunk bed. You know, I don't think sleepwalkers, you know, and I wasn't a sleepwalker. I've never been a sleepwalker. So, yeah, it was just another one of these things. My brother had missing time. My brother was afraid to sleep in his bed when he was between the ages of 6 and 8. I was on the top bunk and he was in the bottom bunk. And I asked my brother, Philip, I said, well, Philip, why don't you sleep in the bed? He said, well, I'm afraid of the little men who come in the night. And he was literally really scared of these, you know, these little entities. And I kind of believed him because I'd kind of seen weird things when I was a kid his age, too. So
right.
It's like I didn't question them. I just said, OK, all right, well, you're sleeping in the closet, you know.
So when starting to do the research into the abduction phenomenon, you can't help but learn about the weird breeding program that they're doing. And believe me, when I first read this, I thought, I have to report this? This is wild, you know? But one of our sources for the book is Professor David M. Jacobs, who in his long career did 10,000 hypnotic regressions on abductees. And about 1,100 of these 10,000 were women that reported being abducted, having had sex with aliens or hybrid beings, and becoming pregnant, and then being taken again 4 months later, and the fetus is stolen. And then sometimes years later, they're abducted again and introduced to their hybrid alien offspring. And I knew this couldn't sound weirder if I were making it up, but it's quite well documented. In fact, there's been situations where the woman will go get an ultrasound and prove that she's pregnant, for sure pregnant. And then the fetus is stolen and she goes back to the doctor. And the doctor, of course, would assume that there's a miscarriage of some kind. But then when he examines her, it doesn't look like a miscarriage. It looks like the whole womb has been vacuumed out, placenta and all.
The doctors would say basically, and this has been in a lot of cases, the obstetrician would say, as far as I can tell, you were never pregnant.
It looks like you were never pregnant.
Never pregnant. And this has happened in some of these women. It's like, it happens 2, 3, 4 times.
Up to 4 times, I've read.
And it seems to be about 5 centimeters, seems to be about the size of the fetus, that as far as when they reach it, about 5 centimeters, which is about the size of a baseball, is about the size when they seem to lose or have the fetus taken. And sometimes they are reintroduced into their offspring at times.
And so, you know, curious, I have a question about when they're reintroduced to their hybrid children. Do they look different? Do they look human? Do they look like a mix?
They look like, they're described as having eyes that are like normal human eyes, but too large.
Disney, slightly too large. Disney character size.
And sometimes with pointier cheekbones or pointier chins than normal. And usually pale hair.
And they also describe too that they seem to have almost like a telepathic. Yeah. They actually kind of can understand. Yeah. It's almost like they're communicating with their actual parents or their offspring telepathically.
Yeah, and they're informed telepathically that this is your child. They get a strong sense of that through telepathy when they meet them. And so You know, looking back at the ancient, book of Enoch and the Watchers and how the gods are supposed to have come and started having sex with humans, taking humans as wives and having children by them. And the fact that these aliens are having sex with us and producing children, I thought, okay, if this is a distant star system race, they can't just have sex with us and have children, right? They must be very close cousins to us physically to be able to have
very, very close.
And I thought, well, that must, at first I thought I was going to find a lot of evidence of in vitro fertilization or genetic manipulation of the fetuses and then implanting them or something like that. But no, they're just having sex and then getting pregnant from aliens somehow. Right. And as soon as we started applying the their cousins, not aliens, to all our data, that's when it really started to make sense to us. And we think that 13,000 years ago is when the separation happened between our race. 13,000 years ago, there was a celestial impact event that we think is the cause of all the great flood myths.
This is what we found, at least so far.
At first, and in the book, I tagged the wrong asteroid impact. I thought it was the Hiawatha, but since then, that one has been dated to 48 million years ago, so we were wrong about that one. But then sure enough, 1,000 miles to the west is they discovered the Younger Dryas comet impact area.
In Lake Superior.
In Lake Superior. Both of these are on either side of the Labrador Sea, which is where we surmised the tsunami originated. So who knew there were two impact areas within 500 miles of the Labrador Sea?
Yeah, separated by 58 million years.
But they were. We knew for many decades, we knew there was some celestial impact event because they discovered nanodiamonds in this 13,000-year-old soil. Mm-hmm. And we surmised that that had to be a celestial impact because nanodiamonds form in no other way. The dust that comes with an asteroid or a meteor or a comet, when it enters our atmosphere, the dust becomes superheated and forms these little microscopic round diamonds called nanodiamonds. And so the Labrador Sea, all around the Labrador Sea area, the concentration of nanodiamonds was very high. And so we surmised that it hit somewhere in that region. And this is what caused the 1,200 different flood myths we have worldwide. This would have caused worldwide tsunamis. And it also is responsible for the destruction of the Clovis people, the mammoth and the mastodon, and there were a lot of big animal extinctions in North America in that time frame. The dire wolf was wiped out, the saber-toothed cat, the American camel, the American horse, mostly our plains animals, right? Where we think that the entire plains were maybe flooded by these tsunamis that hit. Because a comet impact like that will create enormous tsunamis, 1,000, 2,000 foot high. And imagine that rushing to all the coastlines of the world at the same time. So one thing we know from all of these flood myths, almost all of them have a pre-warning. Like God told us that he was about to destroy the world and you'd better either build a boat or some of them say go to high ground. Some of them say dig underground. But somehow you've got to, in order, if you want to survive, you have to do these things in order to survive. And we think that this is where the human race separated into two groups. The people that were able to escape the cataclysm, either by digging in deep cities underground, kind of like the Deep Impact movie, where they took a portion of the population and put them underground, 50,000 people underground, with all their technology intact. Also, we think they may have been a spacefaring race at the time.
They had to have been a spacefaring race because they had to have known that it was coming.
Right.
With like at least 2 years, 1 to 2 years of foreknowledge.
Well,
so we had to have known that.
Right. And there's all these bases around our solar system. There's bases on the moon. There's bases on Mars. There's a base on Phobos, one of the moons of Mars. These structures that are obviously man-made, right?
Have you guys seen
prior to the impact? We were.
You're asking a question there, Declan.
I'm sorry.
Have you guys seen the I think it was one of the pictures that were taken from the Mars rover. You can see one of the Egyptian Ankh symbols, like in one of the rocks on Mars.
The Ankh. Yeah,
And the Pyramid City next to the face.
In fact, there's a really good book out there. It's in the second printing. It's called The Alien Mars Connection, and it's about 100 really good NASA photographs taken on Mars, and MJ Craig just published that. It's in the second printing, and yeah, you can see a lot of the stuff there, you know, including the pyramids and the like say the Ankh, and there's a lot of stuff that is very anomalous. It's not all just pareidolia, you know, where a human mind just thinks that, okay, now this kind of looks like a face, like you know, when you see like a cloud, it says, oh, that looks like a duck, or that looks like a, you know, a horse. You know?
Or if you see Jesus in a pancake, you know.
These are, you know, these are actually, it's a very good text. It's all really good pictures.
If this race of us that survived the impact, they would have kept their technology intact and their knowledge intact. But all of us poor schmucks on the surface, we got almost wiped out to a man. We think that genetically it shows that there's some sort of a bottleneck about this time period where the human race was decimated down to about 10,000 individuals, and our entire population has regenerated from those 10,000.
Our 8 billion have regenerated from 10,000. It was, again, a case of the haves and the have-nots.
Yeah.
You look at what's happening right now, the people that really have a lot of money, they're building, you know, billion-dollar or hundreds of millions of dollars facilities underground.
Bunkers underground, you know,
Literally, they're building their houses with moats around them that can ignite with fire, and they're literally, using geothermal. This is happening right now.
Yeah.
Okay, and so it's like, you know, it's the safest place. I used to be a cave explorer. If you're in a cataclysm or if you're in an earthquake, the safest place to be is underground.
Right.
Okay.
So we think there's these large cities underground. And right after the impact of the Younger Dryas comet, there's a layer of soil after that called the Younger Dryas boundary that shows 1,100 years or at least 1,000 years of drastic climactic upheavals because of the impact, where it would have been impossible to grow crops for hundreds of years.
It would have been very hard, for sure, yes.
Or almost impossible, I should say. And then, so we think that they went underground to survive, but they stayed underground because they just got used to it. It's like we've created an entire race of agoraphobes that are afraid of the sky, and they're living comfortably and happily down below in probably geothermal power.
It just takes a couple of generations for people to get used to something.
Yeah, a single generation, and you wouldn't want to go, if you'd spent your life underground, you wouldn't want to go out. You wouldn't want to come back to the surface.
Well, some adventurers would, but mostly they wouldn't, yeah.
So they kept their technology, whereas all of us on the surface, we were thrown back into the Stone Age and had to start over. When you think about it, human history rarely, if ever, predates 13,000 years ago. There's only a few exceptions to that. The Sumerian tablets talk about ancient times prior to that time period, but almost all human history begins no earlier than 13,000 years ago.
Göbekli Tepes are like around the Tepes.
About 12,000 something years ago. And we think the Göbekli Tepes were populated by the survivors that survived the cataclysm in the underground cities in mid-Turkey called Derinkuyu. There's a couple of other ones that they connect to. We think those people dug in underground to survive. The Anatolian Plateau is very high and
4,700 foot elevation,
and it's about 300 miles from to any coast where there's a large bodies of water. So I think it would have been safe from the tsunamis. But the story from that region is this king was warned by God that a winter like he had never seen was coming, and to dig underground a certain portion of their population and to bring food and their animals down below, kind of like our Ark story,
right.
Except, there's actually not just one Noah. There's 1,200 some odd separate cultures have an ancient flood myth in their most ancient lore, and they all sound remarkably the same. They were all pre-warned and the survivors afterward became kind of they reverted to barbarism and cannibalism, when later a god shows up and teaches them civilization again, how to not be cannibals, how to grow food and animal husbandry and architecture and math, and all this stuff was retaught to us by a god that visited us after the flood.
Like the Viracochas.
And we think that this points to the same people that survived with their technology intact. I think they kind of took pity on us at one point and said, we've got to do something about these poor surface people who are, they're looks like they're going to go extinct, you know, because they've reverted to cannibalism and complete barbarism.
Let's let them ask some questions, okay?
Okay.
So,
you know, we get started. You know?
We were closing in on almost an hour here. Curious about like one big takeaway from your book. Is there something that you were the most surprised about when you were researching it, or that is like the big message that you want to convey with your book?
One of the things that was important to me was we think that the government, the U.S. government, became aware of these beings underneath the ice sheet due to the incidents involving Admiral Byrd at the South Pole.
By the way, we call them intraterrestrials in the book. to make it the distinction, they're not living on, they actually cohabitate with us in large, large cities, you know, that have, they have the technology to do it.
We coined the phrase intraterrestrial rather than extraterrestrial. Although if they're, you know, they're coming here from different areas in our own solar system, then they're still extraterrestrial if they're coming here from Mars, say, or from some of the other bases. But most of the time we think they're launching their UFOs from underground. And we think that Admiral Byrd, as I said, was the when our government discovered that these beings are real. And they then made this pact between our government and them to keep their secret. And that's why they fight so hard against disclosure. And they've just been lying to us for almost 100 years now.
In fact, about 2 months ago, they backtracked on what they were saying at the congressional hearings in the summer of 2023. Now the Pentagon is saying that we have found no proof that extraterrestrials, see the way they couch this phrase, they found no conclusive proof that extraterrestrials are visiting our planet, because they're not really extraterrestrials,
right?
They're intraterrestrials.
That's a way of sort of telling
us
the truth.
This is how you lie with semantics. You lie. You're not really telling a falsehood, but you're not really telling the truth. So it's just, you know, it just blows my mind. But you know, for me, what I took away from when we started doing the research, I didn't realize just at the beginning, I didn't realize that, you know, that this old Glegley was actually an alien. It didn't really occur to me. So when we started putting the pieces together, it started to make a lot more sense to me.
And we started comparing notes with other family members. And that's when we heard about Phillips actually seeing the tall gray alien in his room. And that's when we started to put together what was going on. It has all the signatures of the abduction phenomenon, this thing where you're terrified and then suddenly black out and have no memory for 3 hours and then end up back in your bed 3 hours later.
I definitely want to get into more of Stephen's family stories in our Patreon episode. So we are going to be doing a second episode with Leslie and Stephen, talking more about the specific incidences with the family and the history and the stories. And that is going to be exclusively on Patreon. So if people are interested in hearing more about those incredible stories, then come follow us on Patreon and you can hear it there. Was there anything else, Declan? Any other questions that you had?
No, I've got some questions for the Patreon, but
Okay.
None right now.
Leslie, Stephen, was there anything else that you wanted to cover in this episode before we go to our exclusive?
I don't think so.
About halfway through the book, we've gotten about halfway through the book with our theories, and the theories continue on as to whether there is any alien involvement at all. And we think that there is, and if they want to know more about that, they'll have to get the book.
Yes, they will have to go get the book.
Okay. That alludes something.
Again, who they are and what they're up to by Leslie and Stephen Shaw.
Right.
That alludes to something that I want to talk about in the Patreon. I'll give our listeners a little tidbit, but I do want to talk to you guys about Project Bluebeam and your thoughts on that, if you guys are familiar with that.
Bluebeam?
Project Blue Book, you mean?
Yes.
Bluebeam.
Or Bluebeam, Blue Book or Blue I believe.
Beam? Blue Book ended in 69, but there's now it's Arrow that took over from ATIP.
They've never really ended it. just changed the name every few decades.
I'm not familiar with Blue Beam. I'm familiar with Blue Book, with Hynek's work.
Yeah. So we'll talk about Blue Beam then, because it's an interesting theory that I've heard about.
Okay.
So, all right, let's pop on over to Patreon.
Hey, friends. Thank you for supporting our podcast. Please share our show with your brutal and bizarre friends. Give us a boozy follow on your favorite podcast platform. If you're feeling extra generous, we'd appreciate a 5-star rating or review as well. But maybe do that sober so all the letters are in the right place.
You can find all our contact information in the show notes. We love hearing from you, and if you're interested in helping us stock the bar for our future boozy episodes, you can find our Patreon link in the show notes as well.